The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Now, I told you I was going to have a look at the business stories that are making this morning's papers, and delighted to be joined by Declan Ralph of the BWG Group, which includes the Spar, Mace and XL brands. Also joining us is Susan Hayes-Cullerton, a.k.a. the Positive Economist, and congratulations on her recent elevation here. She's now the presenter of Taking Stock right here on this station. So a colleague now, Susan, which is wonderful news.
Thanks, Bobby.
So we're going to give you the honour of getting us started and to tell us about the coalition gripped by growing dread about a failure to tackle the housing prices.
Well, thanks for the compliment there to be starting me off on that. First of all, before we get into the story, I just want to echo your congratulations to everyone last night. And while nobody can tell, I am wearing Amy Connolly's primer today as well. So just back you up there on that.
Thank you for that, Susan.
Okay, so Jack Horgan-Jones, in the Irish Independent is talking about this story today. And there's a range of different elements and parameters going on in here. He's talking about the focus on the independents and how a lot of the media attention has been going to one in particular. He's talking about the pace of the delivery of housing as well, how it was set at a very high level by the predecessor of Minister James Brown when it was set at 40,000 units a year, and how that's going to be very difficult to deliver. He's talking about the transition between, not the transition between the parties, but between the personalities in the parties, and also the backlogs for disabilities and other groups. So in essence, Bobby, what he's saying here is that housing isn't being delivered at the pace that it was promised, and it's probably going to be the issue that the whole government is going to hang on.
And they're on the back foot because that misrepresentation of the numbers has left a sour taste in the electorate's mouth in terms of the delivery of the numbers. We were told it was 40 and it ended up being 30. So that's the backdrop to this, which makes people kind of angry. And Declan, I was interested in your take maybe on the Housing Czar appointment. One Brendan McDonough, formerly of NAMA, a civil servant of some pedigree, no doubt, but maybe a curious appointment as a Housing Czar.
Yeah, I think so, Bobby. A curious appointment, all right. Some TDs have expressed surprise, unnamed TDs, of course, that Brendan McDonough, chief executive of NAMA, the bad bank, as we know it more affectionately, as the new housing czar. You know, even the fact of having a housing czar, you know, it just feels like it's somebody else to blame as opposed to the minister, who might be actually responsible.
I think it was described as someone to kick down doors.
Yeah.
It was a kind of an aggressive term.
And a maverick, but yeah, as you said in your introduction there, Mr. McDonough, he is certainly a career civil servant, certainly worked in the National Treasury Management Agency as well, and has been. There's also a curious thing, Bobby, around the fact that he dealt with all these developers and builders in NAMA.
Yeah.
Probably not
enough space.
He might not be on their Christmas card list, let's say. And, some of them might feel a little bit hard done by him. So now him coming back to encourage them to actually build and invest, it might be a challenging role for him and for the government.
But there's a couple of other things going on here that I think are worthwhile looking at that are external. One is we see Revolut are potentially going to be joining the mortgage market by the autumn.
Yeah.
Two is that we see energy efficient homes now are commanding a premium of 30% in the mortgage market. And three is that there was an increase of 8.9% in the sales of new homes in the first quarter of the year. So this is all going on, and all of these, the three things I've mentioned there, are external to what's going on in this story. So this is what they're currently facing with, is more money coming into the market and people are looking for greener, newer homes.
Yeah, very true. And a good summary, Susan. Moving to US matters, Declan, poll shows US president is losing support on several fronts. I'll be talking to Cliff Taylor a little bit about this later in the programme, but it is kind of interesting watching this unfurl, let's say.
It is, yeah. There's a number of polls, actually. Two or three different polls are showing a couple of different areas down. The respondents who approve of Trump's actions was 45%. That's his actions in relation to immigration. And then it's 46% were opposed to him. So he's now on the slide down, if you like, and a lot of that is fueled by the El Salvadoran man, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was deported. Seems like from all of the information about him, he should not have been deported.
Yeah.
They've said that they need to bring him back, the Supreme Court, but that hasn't happened as well. There's a YouGov poll specifically about that issue as well. And again, 50% of US adults believe that he should be returned immediately. Wow. And then there's a DDHQ The Hill poll, which indicates Trump's overall approval has dropped from above 50% in January down to just under 45% today. So there's a lot going on there. And he's heading back into the territory where Biden was on a number of issues.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Let's move the story on, Susan, because it's really interesting to watch the performance of Tesla, of Elon Musk, again, you know, heavily involved in the Doge in terms of controlling government expenditure. But it seems to be at huge business cost to his business. And I'm not sure he cares about his reputation, but his business has been impacted massively.
Oh, massively. I mean, Tesla is down 50% from its peak, and that is a really big deal for Tesla. But there's a couple of things going on here. First of all, I was on the earnings call. I actually was on as it was being delivered. And like the first, ordinarily on an earnings call, by the way, an earnings call is when a company who's listed has an hour long session with investors to explain what's going on and what it's looking at.
So you went on the call, yeah?
Yeah, I went on the call. Actually, the first couple of minutes was very, very, very political, party political. It had nothing to do with Tesla. It was all about the protests and so on like that. And anybody can go and read the transcript, go and see what he said. But he also then said, well, look, you know, maybe I need to start spending a bit more time on Tesla. And he's going to spend less time now on Doge. And he's going to be reducing that down to a day or 2 weeks, depending on what's needed. And it's just interesting, Bobby, that was the start of the Tesla earnings call was where he was spending the time. But then as things went on, then look, basically, it's really bad. Revenue slid 9% in the year. The earnings per share sank 40 cents to 27 cents. And also, in addition as well, the reality here is that you're seeing decade-long changes here. You're not seeing the growth that was there before. But one of the things that Joe Brennan mentions, and I think that this is well worthwhile considering, is that Tesla doesn't sell through brokers necessarily, or salespeople. It sells directly. And the key issue that he's bringing up here at the very end is that he says, considering Tesla's enormous scale, low-cost designs and applied efficiencies in manufacturing, he said, this really does say something other companies should be asking themselves. If Tesla can't make money with electric vehicles, what makes us think we can? And BYD, Build Your Dreams, is the Chinese competitor just going streets ahead now. And whatever.
Top Tesla sales, 97.7 billion last year.
Exactly.
Big numbers.
Big numbers. Yeah. Big, big, big numbers.
Declan, Apple's plan to move iPhone production to India shows the folly of Trump's tariff logic. Again, a piece under cancel in today's Irish Times. It is interesting to read this. And again, I'll be asking Cliff Taylor yesterday, like, companies ultimately work for the shareholders.
They do.
Like, no matter what government influences are there, it's going to be driven by the shareholder needs.
Well, it gives the as the article says, it more or less gives the lie to the idea that big businesses will, you know, move their business and their manufacturing and their operations back to the US. As you say, their first loyalty and first responsibility is to their shareholder. So therefore, like any big company, Apple will shift to another low-cost area where it might be slightly easier and there's a lower tariff in play. So, you know, the only danger, I suppose, Bobby, here is, and the article refers to this as well, is that, you know, Trump will probably try to put this in as a win for him, because even though the jobs are not coming back to America...
Well, it's a blow to China.
It's a kick in the teeth for China. Yeah. So he'll see that
so
as
an
a win.
Indirect hit.
Yeah.
Susan?
Yeah, I think this Apple in general, it's such an interesting company. Again, I went on that earnings call recently. And by the way, sorry, the one.
What do you do in your day job?
Didn't you announce it at the beginning, Bobby? But, by the way, the last earnings call for Apple was in January. The next one is on Thursday, right? And the gross profit margin on an iPhone is around 40. The gross profit margin on Apple is about 47% in general. Now, any sort of move on that, and that is because they have have really, really squeezed as much out of the supply chain as they can by deciding where to put it. Like even moving everything to India, well, not everything, but just we'll say that some elements of the manufacturing is going to cost the company quite a lot. And who's to say that the tariffs on India won't change in 2 minutes? Like this is the issue there. What's interesting as well is that the iPhone is worth 55% of Apple's revenue. So it's a big, these are big, big decisions that they're making, and they're making them on the respective decision making of somebody who can change their mind in a tweet.
Yeah. Just watching AIB during the week there, Declan, will AIB pull the state stock buyback terms if it fails to rally by the AGM? They need to be careful here, do they not? Because, again, it's the taxpayer that's involved. It's a buyback from state ownership, which is probably a good thing to see it exit state ownership, but again, at what price?
Yeah, it is. And we almost have all our money back. We put in 21 billion-ish and we have around 19 billion back. So over the period of time, you know, we do have most of our money back. But it is interesting that all of this is influenced by everything we've just been talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why the price is down. It's because of all the volatility and because of Donald's tweets or whatever he might do. So it is very interesting. But they do have to make a serious, you know, call on it at the right time. AIB obviously have a responsibility to the other shareholders as well, so to make sure that everybody is getting the best value possible for money. But they have a little bit of time. They have until May the 8th, not that long, and it might rally back up the price a little before.
Any earnings call there, you might go on.
Well, the one to watch here is actually the AGM that's on Thursday, because they're going to have to certainly discuss it here. I mean, the thing is that the price was set off a month ago at 6.26 and it has fallen 9% as a result of all sorts of developments. But the thing is that they have to make a decision by the 8th of May, and that's the one to watch. I mean, look, at the moment it's saying if the price got back up to, it's currently at 5.71, if it got up to around about €6, it looks like that this could go ahead, and I think this would be good then, obviously for the country, but possibly for the bank as well.
Yeah. Staying with banking, Susan, the credit union, again, another great institution out there, lending up 12% buoyed by mortgages. And again, I think this is reflective of some change in legislation that allows credit unions to play in this space.
I think credit unions were largely absent. Apart from regulation, the interest rates are just so much higher over the past decade in comparison to what the bank was offering. And of course, now it's kind of coming more aligned in that. This ties in with the first story that we looked at as well, which is that there's now new money again coming into the mortgage market potentially. So now it says that credit union lending is up by 12%, as you say, buoyed by mortgages. And then Ronan Smith also mentions that new home loans surged 47% to 302 million. The mortgage market in Ireland is worth around about 12.6 billion. So the fact, you know, that it's surging to 302 million is small money in the grand scheme of things. But for the credit union market, for a start, it makes a big difference. There's currently conversations being had with the central bank, etc., to allow credit unions to lend up to the equivalent of 30% of their total assets by way of home mortgages. That would be a significant structural change. The other thing that I think is interesting as well to note here is that it's actually only recently that they have been able to club together to provide loans, like actually one credit union working with another, so that they've to introduce a corporate credit union, which is a credit union for credit unions. So I think that there's a lot of structural change going on here. But on the other hand as well, there still is an awful lot more capacity in credit unions to loan and to lend out.
Even though, Declan, we're seeing that the number of active credit unions has fallen.
But a lot of that is due to
consolidation
of various individual or, you know, smaller credit union groups into bigger groups.
Yeah.
And that consolidation gives them the size and the scale to be able to do the mortgage business and so on.
Yeah. Maybe moving into your own sector, Declan, interesting piece in the Mail today, the rising cost of your shopping basket. And, you know, as somebody who doesn't, and probably should, meticulously scrutinise what the price of everything that's in the shopping basket. There's some interesting things happening here that I certainly wasn't aware of.
Yeah, the subheading there is war, unrest, and Trump's dread of tariffs again are hitting us where it hurts. And it is, a lot of it is down to that geopolitical sort of situation and rising costs of energy, of people, you know, supply chain issues that we would have talked about, fuel, And increased regulation, Bobby, for businesses is another reason why costs are going up. So apart from, you know, the worldwide things you can't influence too much, there's other things maybe that we could influence or try to influence closer to home. But there's that comparison then. There's loads of different products here, from pizza to fish fingers and rice.
Yeah, well, even just looking at fish fingers.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, 10 codfish fingers, 280 grams. In 2023, they were 435. They've fallen in price to 399. That's 36 cents. But in the same category, other fish fingers, the fishmonger, 10 breaded codfish fingers, 300 grams, 135 up to 199. That's 64 cents up. Yeah. That doesn't make sense to me.
Well, one of those is a branded product.
Yeah.
So it's the A brand. It's the Bird's Eye product, whereas the other product is a private label of one of the discounters. So you probably see that because the private label product is substantially cheaper anyway, some of the A brands are now trying to bring the price down a little to
And it does also show you, does it not, the improvement maybe in quality in own label.
Yeah.
Well, where own label stands against an own brand.
Absolutely. In general, own label is of very good quality across our own brands and our competitor brands. So, you know, that is something that shoppers see.
Yeah.
So they see that the quality is there and that the value is there.
You were looking at the price of tea bags, I know, Susan, yeah.
I was looking for Barry's here, but I didn't find it. So anyway, but yeah, I did notice here Lions in particular went up 138, which is in stark contrast in the case here of Lidl, where it says Fallon's Gold Blend 80 tea bags have fallen by 140. And I know my dad likes to buy tea bags now in boxes of 40 because it'll last him a good bit. So I'm just looking here, though. There's a few things that stand out to me. One is the fall in the price of white bread.
Yeah.
In the vast majority of cases, except one, when it came to Tesco, Dunnes, Aldi and Lidl, that it had fallen there in each of those cases. And, you know, I remember just reminded that when the barcode came in back in the 80s, that my granny said to my mum, check your receipt now, because the computer now knows the price of everything. And the thing is that now we should be knowing the price of everything, not just relying on the barcode.
But competition, of course, drives down the price as
of
well.
Course,
so that can help. Yeah.
Very briefly, Rory Gallagher's guitar. Tell us about it, if you would, Declan.
Well, the government and Micheál Martin in particular were very keen that it would stay in Irish hands. It went on sale in London. And Dennis Desmond, stepped up to the mark, and he bought it for 1.1 million, and it has stayed in Ireland basically. And the only disappointment is that it's not going to be housed in Cork; it's going to be housed in the National Museum here, NMI here in Collins Barracks in Dublin. And the other good thing from a business point of view, there's a tax break in return for the generosity of $920.
Isn't that a good thing?
I think it is.
We'll leave it on the high notes.
Yes.
Susan Hayes-Cullerton and Declan Ralph, thank you both very much for your contribution. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk to you both soon.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.